Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
I have a radical idea. We'll cross the streams.
Excuse me, Egon. You said crossing the streams was bad.
Cross the streams.
Hello once again, everybody. Welcome to Crossing Streams, your weekly television streaming podcast out of San Diego, California. Craig Elston back with you for episode number 181 as we continue to try and wade our way through the large rushing river of prestige streaming content coming our way. We've been playing furious catch-up here on the feed, and at the same time trying to stay topical, trying to stay on top of the things that are happening as they're happening and what's happening this week. Better Call Saul, mid-season finale, seventh episode of season six dropped. They'll take a little break till July, and they will wrap it up. And so we are here to wrap up the previous four episodes, and in particular focus on the mid-season finale plan and execution. And joining me once again, since episode one, he's been my Better Call Saul correspondent. The candle flickered twice as he entered the room. It's Ben Higgins.
Hello, Craig. Luckily, this podcast doesn't lose participants as quickly as characters are falling by the wayside on Better Call Saul.
Yeah, otherwise we'd already be done.
Yes, we'd be out.
Nacho. And now poor Howard. So this is, just in case you didn't notice, we're going to recap and thus spoil everything that's happened through seven episodes. If you have not watched the seventh episode all the way to the finish, please stop this podcast now and come back when you have. Okay, we're going to dive into the big moments and then we'll kind of get through the plan and the execution. But Ben, we talked about this 4 weeks ago when we talked about episodes one through three, and we mentioned how season five, episode 10's title was something unforgivable. And that was part of the phrase of the discussion that Jimmy and Kim had under the covers, talking about what could they do to Howard to get the Sandpoint lawsuit to settle. And now we know what that meant. Something unforgivable was what Jimmy and Kim were going to do to Howard, and the unexpected circumstances that would lead to this being Howard's last episode.
Yeah. I love, there was a few moments, of course, where, you know, kind of the jaw drops. And I think part of the thing that I love about Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad was the clever plot crafting, and, you know, when they pull off a con, you know, how they stay a step ahead of their marks. And they did that really, really well once again in the half season finale. You know, there was a couple of points where it finally came together for me, like, what are they doing? Why is this? What's going on? And then, oh, the light bulb goes on, and all of a sudden it's go, oh, here's what they're doing. Here's what they've been plotting. And that's one of the things that I enjoy the most about the show.
Yeah, we had the caper, right? And really, and we'll even talk about it more, but really, I think that episodes, you know, our previous podcast, we saw that episodes one and two were there. They were good episodes, but they were all in service of episode three, Nacho's swan song, and what a powerful episode it was. And I really feel the same way about this batch, my friend. I feel like episodes four, five, and six were all elaborate setups to get us to episode seven and to allow episode seven to pay off. And while along that road, I'd say episodes four through six were slower, and maybe even you might've been able to do it in one, what they did in three. Nonetheless, all of that classic, as you said, meticulous, careful, craftful setup allows this caper to come rolling out through the first half of this episode that, you know, invokes all of the great fun we've had in the Gould Gilligan universe for years.
You know, and I do enjoy when they give you even more characters and expand the universe. Like, I never envisioned Lalo going to Germany and meeting Margarete, the widow, you know, of the engineer who was in charge of building the meth lab. I mean, it's so, that is so detailed. Most shows would even go three steps from that, and Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul always take you even further and further and deeper and deeper. And it's something that I truly enjoy.
What was your reaction to the decision to have Howard meet his end here in such a kind of clinical fashion by Lalo, just matter-of-factly walking into the room and blowing him away?
I thought the scene was one of the best of the series, and the actors and the reaction and the horror of it, you know, the casual horror of it. Lalo Salamanca has been, and I love how every Salamanca has been kind of a different villain with a different personality. Yeah. Lalo, to me, is the scariest of all of them. You know, you go back with, you know, Hector and his anger and fury. You go back to Tuco and just the wild man that he is. But Lalo, the smiling villain, is to me the scariest. And he's so casual in his brutality. And that's something that even shocks Jimmy, you know, in that last segment. It shocks Kim there in that last scene. So I did enjoy that. And I thought it would, might have even been a better ending, because it was so sudden and unexpected than what happened with Nacho, which was also great, but we saw that coming. We talked about how there's no way out for Nacho. We see him, he's cornered, all the characters are coming back. We knew that that was going to be the end for Nacho with it. You know, we would have been totally surprised if it wasn't. This one, though, came out of complete left field and was one of those really jaw-dropping moments that you get with great television.
You know, one of the things that you guys do so well on your morning show, Ben and Woods, which folks can listen to on 97.3 The Fan, 97.3 FM here in San Diego, weekday mornings, is a phrase, commitment to the bit.
phrase than mine, but yes.
Yes. And the Jimmy and Kim had an incredible commitment to the bit, but in particular, Kim, when it came to this caper and this attempt to take down Howard. And to me, what that final scene did, you know, I think about all those Mike Erman Trout, you're in the game or you're out of the game, you know, and we heard that all the way back to Breaking Bad. Now Kim's in the game. Kim's 100% in the game. And Kim found out that the game can extend beyond the boundaries of the court. She thought that she could play in this clever headspace with Jimmy, you know, just a more elaborate version, essentially, of what allowed them to get the top shelf tequila, you know, back in whatever it was, season two. And that the most harm that would come to it would be, you know, whatever she had kind of gamed out in her head. And then here we see these two timelines that have existed for six seasons, you know, a legal timeline, cartel timeline. We've seen them intersect last season, but now they've intersected maybe for good. I don't even know when we'd be spending too much more time in the legal field in the next six episodes. I feel like this is cartel and Gene Takovic the rest of the way.
Yeah. Once, you know, you got rid of Howard, and you, of course, earlier in the show, got rid of Jimmy's brother, Charles, you know, the legal course. Maybe Kim has something legal left in her that she can do somewhere, but you're right. It does feel like it's going to be focused more on what happens with the cartel and Lalo going forward. The one, I don't want to call it a complaint, but the one thing that I thought failed to maybe not quite meet the high standards of Better Call Saul, I still don't get the motivation. It wasn't strong enough for such an elaborate ruse on Howard, just to the Sandpiper settlement that's been going on for so long, you know, to speed up the process now a little bit. I didn't feel like that they, you know, they wanted to help the old people that much, get their money that much to pull off such an elaborate ruse and con on Howard. Almost, I felt, was not quite earned the motivation for it. But that was maybe nitpicking on one complaint I had about it.
No, let's dig into this. I don't know if that's a nitpick at all. I mean, because it's, to me, the biggest question of these four episodes. At the end of episode six, Kim's on the phone. You know, she's driving to Santa Fe, and she's driving to Santa Fe to basically get everything that she's looking for originally from the Sandpiper settlement, the ability to work robustly in this pro bono field to have the money to be able to take care of these underprivileged clients. Like, that was the supposedly ideal foundation behind this devious plan at the end of season five. But now, really, Davis and Maine has taken that away, right? I mean, they've given her the opportunity to do what she wanted to do. And so that's the thing that kind of sticks with me too, and that I'm hoping the last six episodes help us resolve. We've seen these glimpses into Kim's past. We understand that grift is now something that, you know, has been part of her life through her formative years. But why would you turn around when in the end, what you're doing, you know, getting the Sandpiper settlement, there is a glacial path to that if you do nothing.
It is, I guess, you know, Breaking Bad was about a person's journey breaking bad. And at the beginning of Better Call Saul, I did feel like Jimmy was almost too good to become the character that he was in Breaking Bad. There was so like a lot of humanity in Jimmy that you never really saw in the Breaking Bad part of the universe after, the first show. And when I went back and rewatched Breaking Bad with a specific eye on what Saul Goodman was, he was so crass in that show and so different from the Jimmy that we really learned about in the first, you know, 3 to 4 seasons of his character, that maybe they do need to accelerate his descent into really being a sleazy scumbag lawyer that he became, and needed something harsh like this to make it believable to where he was in the Breaking Bad section of the universe.
Yeah. The biggest thing I'm going to be focused on when this show comes back is I'm ripping things from the back of the menu and putting them at the front, but that's fine. How are these two people going to live through the next scene? Because it would seem to me like Lalo would have a good reason to get the information he wants and kill them, which is what he's done every other step of the way along this process to try and take down Gus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that Jimmy and Kim really have done anything that Lalo knows to betray him or whatever, other than, you know, serve as a reluctant but good lawyer for them. So it's possible that, you know, he needs them for some other avenue that we have yet to see, that they're still going to be useful for Lalo. Seems like obviously they have to live through the next scene. That would really be a surprise if they don't. So, you know, my guess is that there's something that he needs them to do to further the plot for the last six episodes.
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so that kind of gets us into Lalo's plan. And so maybe I should just put a pin in that and hang on to it for just a second. I think we've hit the big reactions at the top here. I'll just ask this before we take our first break and we get into the plan and the execution. When you look at those four episodes now in retrospect, did you find any issues with the pacing of it, or was episode 7 so good that it paid off everything?
I did think that the previous three episodes were a little slow in the setup of the con. You know, the level of detail that they went into it was even a lot for Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. So you probably could have consolidated a little bit, but you know, that's not what the show is. That, you know, the show, especially Better Call Saul, has been expanding beyond what you ever thought possible of the timeline of Saul Goodman. So I guess they're staying consistent with themselves the worst thing about Game of Thrones, just throw a completely different show onto it, was how they accelerated everything in the last season. Everything always took so long. You couldn't even move a character from one place to another. It would take an entire season to get them across Westeros. And then at the end, just to, you know, tie up all their plot points, they sped everything up to ridiculous proportions. It really ruined it for me. You don't want to see Better Call Saul do that and hit the gas over the last few episodes just to get where they want to go. So if anything, I'm better riding the brake like they have always done and keep it as slow as ever, so you don't change the timing and pacing of the show.
You know, it's fascinating. This is a fascinating thing, Ben, what you're talking about, because there's six episodes left in this series. So if they keep up their pace, there's very little left to do.
We may be a day or two in showtime from the end of Better Call Saul, if you think about it. I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's the Gene Tankovic forward part that I think, and we'll talk about that, that's probably going to have to play a role, obviously, a considerable one. But in terms of in Albuquerque with Kim and Jimmy, we may be right in the end game. And the way they stretch things out, it may be just a few days time of whatever happens that leaves us with the end of that portion of the show. So you're right. We might be right at the end of the timeline here.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting. We'll delve into that a little bit more at the end of the podcast. Let's take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to get into the plan that leads to the execution that leads to Howard's execution right here on Crossing Streams.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan. And we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void. We're prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, quick reminder, Crossing Streams, the Evergreen podcast filled with all of the shows that you might be finishing at different pace than someone else. For example, our very last podcast was a complete nerd culture catch up. If you go back to Crossing Streams 180, hey, have you gone to see Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness? When you do, Ken Garden and I have a complete review of what I thought was one of the best movies in the MCU history. Plus, we wrapped up Moon Knight. We wrapped up the Batman. So have you seen those things? Episode 180 is for you. Did you finish Outer Range on Amazon? The completely weird and pretty good Josh Brolin sci-fi / Yellowstone season. Ryan Phillips and I wrapped that up on episode 179 of Crossing Streams. And episode 178 was our Ozark finale mega podcast review. So when you're done with Ozark, you head on over to Crossing Streams 178. Just surf through past episodes, find whatever show you're wrapping up, and we've got the conversation right there for you. I'm conversing with Ben Higgins, my dear friend from Ben and Woods, and from decades beyond that as well in terms of our professional relationship. But I'll be talking to him Friday morning on the Ben and Woods radio program with some more Crossing Streams recommendations. We already know that we love Better Call Saul. Let's get into plan and execution. And Ben, I got to say, you know, just kind of cruising episodes 4 through 6, the setup of the caper was a lot of fun. I think you knew that this was going to be a bad choice road for Jimmy and for Kim, but whether it was the whole elaborate scene when Howard was at therapy to steal his car and to go get Wendy from the Breaking Bad hotel and to, you know, have Kim's meeting with Mr. Davis, you're right, with Ed Begley Jr. to be right in line with that whole, and the whole nonsense with pulling out the pole and all of that, you know, just every step of the way, I feel like was kind of that, what you were talking about, the fun of watching the Swiss watch turn on this show.
Yeah, and I really thought, obviously, you know, Howard was pretty savvy to most of it. You know, he knew he was being targeted. He knew it early. He knew the bowling balls. He knew it was Jimmy. And you felt like when he hired the private investigator, I expected, oh, this is going to be the monkey wrench, the problem that Jimmy and Kim are going to have to overcome, the twist that they didn't see coming. So when the reveal came that it wasn't the twist at all, that Jimmy and had hired the private investigator and it was a double cross to begin with, I really enjoyed that part of it when I realized just a split second before the reveal, oh my God, the PI is in on it with Jimmy. I can't believe I didn't see that, but that's Jimmy for you. And he was always a step ahead of Howard, even when he let Howard think that Howard was a step ahead of Jimmy.
Yeah. And that, you know, that great boxing scene, which really seemed gratuitous at the time, it seemed kind of stagey and one of the least realistic things I'd seen on the show. What I loved though, was the lament back at Kim's apartment where he said, like, I let him suck me into his game. You know, why did I let him do that? And Kim just says, 'cause you know what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah. That was because they already knew they had covered all their bases, at least so they thought, and that they were going to win because they had it all sewn up tightly.
I guess we could have seen it coming, Ben, that this was going to be the end for Howard, because we got some of the best give Howard humanity, give Howard a much more positive side. Let's show all of his good facets over these last three episodes.
Troubled home life, all of a
exactly.
sudden.
Exactly.
A lot of Howard here.
I mean, really, that I thought the therapy scene was a really good scene. And I thought it was excellent acting by Patrick Fabian, who has the combination of that. He's been in so many courtrooms. He knows how to have that professional veneer. So he's even got a version of it where he takes it down, but he's still got a little bit. You know, I thought it was absolutely outstanding. But you referenced that
radio voice that even I would kill for.
Patrick, oh my God. Yeah, so good.
Unbelievable pipes. I mean, that is, he really, really has a great voice.
And speaking of great voices and great voiceover voices, the man who directed episode 6, and I was this week years old when I found out the proper way to pronounce his last name is Giancarlo Esposito.
Not Esposito, like, oh, interesting.
Esposito. Yeah, Esposito. He was a guest on, and which, by the way, I completely and highly recommend the Breaking Bad Insider, or pardon me, the Better Call Saul Insider podcast, which previously was the Breaking Bad Insider podcast, but it comes out the day after the episode, and it's hosted by Gilligan and
Giancarlo Esposito, like a very big gringo all along.
Right? Yeah. Well, so is everyone, but it's Esposito. But he was the director of that episode, and I'll circle it back. He directed this incredible scene, which is the first and only time we ever see Howard with his wife. And I thought was just so revealing of the character. And Howard, in a way, Ben, reminds me of a Gus Fring without the power. He's got that meticulousness. He's got that desire to be neat. He's got, everything needs to be exactly right. Everything needs to be in its place. But, you know, Gus Fring combines that with the deadly power of his drug cartel, and for Howard, all he has is the hopeless gesture of creating a foam peace symbol in the perfectly created latte that his wife then, just without even a look, dumps into her travel cup to go on to the. I've my heart broke for Howard in that moment.
He has the meticulousness. He doesn't have the ruthlessness, though, and that's the difference. That's why he was a patsy all in this show. That, you know, you can't survive in this world without a certain degree of ruthlessness. I mean, we see every character who doesn't gets played from Breaking Bad on forward. If you don't have that ruthlessness, you're not going to make it.
The other part of the setup really was Lalo over the last couple of episodes popping up in Germany. And I really enjoyed the episode where he was, you know, the dashing, you know, and debonair killer, you know, in the margarita scenes, and then how they set us up in his home invasion moment. You know, is he going to kill her? I thought that was great. The scene in the forest was wild.
Yeah, a little sloppy by Lalo, I thought. He had the upper hand and let it get away pretty easily.
Pretty easily. That could have gone completely wrong for Lalo. Also, you know, was he so sure that that guy could tie off his leg properly before he'd bleed out? Hopefully he got that. Apparently he did. Apparently he got the information in a timely fashion. And then I just can't wait to see all the memes that'll come from Lalo with his binoculars in the drain grate, looking at the Laundromat Brillante and mixing that with Pennywise the Clown. Like, how many different memes are we going to get from that?
You know, and one of the things that showed about Lalo, of course, and I'm talking to, you know, I said how he's probably the number one villain we've really seen, even beyond maybe Gus Fring. He outthought Mike, because it was Mike who set up the level of separation that you thought was so ridiculous, you know, sending all of the engineers off on different flights and, you know, covering the tracks, that there's no possible way that anyone is. I mean, I thought it was ridiculous at the time. You know, they didn't even have contact with Margareta at the funeral. They talked about this was all Mike's doing, setting up, but just based on the Lucite, the whatever, the little engineer, the ruler, whatever that was in there with the names on it and the name of the town that he found out on the call that was mistakenly made where the hot springs were, that was enough for Lalo to get in and completely undo all of Mike's preparation and everything he did to try to keep that word from getting to the Salamanca family.
And the Lalo outwits Mike strategy, the play on the board continued in the sewer, and it took me twice watching for me to really understand this. When Lalo calls Hector Salamanca to update him basically on what's going on, that he has spotted Mike, that he has spotted, you know, that he knows there's an operation going on, and he hears a little trill, like a little chirp on the line,
like an extra click of some sort that's in there. I did notice it the first time. I thought that's significant, I think. And because you know how Gus and Mike detailed oriented they are, that they wouldn't have that base covered. So I did sort of see what they were doing there. And then I realized what Lalo was saying to Hector was then a ruse at that point, because he knew they were hearing what he was saying.
I thought that was so brilliantly set up, because, I mean, really, you have to just play along. They don't spell it out. There's so many millions of other scripts where when he hung up and smashed the chair, he would have said, how did they know to bug the phone?
Yeah, they didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
He would have just yelled that out in the inside the sewer. How did they know to bug that phone? I know what I'll do, and I'll call him back, you know, but instead, all it is in Spanish, clever chicken man, clever, clever chicken man, you know, and then he settles himself and he calls back. And right. Plan A, big surprise. And as soon as I heard Mike say, we've pulled all the security off the low targets, I was like, uh-oh. And at first I thought, are they going to go kill Nacho's dad? Because that was one of the ones that he's always been like making a point, like, no, my guys are on there. And I thought that could be a horrible, because I heard it was going to be something shocking in the last episode. I'm like, that would have been absolutely horrible if they went and killed Nacho's dad. That'd just be, it'd be so untimely, cruel, unnecessary.
And I hadn't even made the connection when Mike said that, but that was clearly because they had warned Kim and Jimmy, you know, you're going to see these guys, they're watching you. So they had to undo that. How did Lalo get to see Kim and Jimmy without Mike knowing about it? They set that up by him saying, we've pulled them off some of the low profile targets to protect the main man, Gus.
Exactly. And that's never going to be Lalo's plan. Lalo's going to go talk to his lawyers, as it turns out. Meanwhile, a couple of notes from the execution part of this, the caper part of it. Centrifugal force? Well, they,
oh, well, can. Is that true? Does that work? I was fascinated. I was like, this is unbelievable. This is.
I figured you immediately, knowing you, I figured you immediately went to your kitchen, shook a can, and tried it.
I was scared. I didn't want to spray soda over everywhere.
Apparently, it's true. I heard an interview. Tom Schnaus, who was the writer director, said he actually learned that as a kid, I think, from his dad. And it's kind of the same idea as tapping the can, which some people do. But yeah, apparently, if you do that, I really, really want to try. Honestly, I really, really want to try.
All right. Next time I drop a soda and before I open, I'm going to try the centrifugal force.
Just another great humanizing moment for Howard, though. A really cool kind of behind the scenes note is that Mr. Show alum John Ennis was cast as the fake judge, the actor who's out there muttering lines from Angels in America while stacking carts in the parking lot.
Judge Casimiro.
Right. And then actor who plays the fake judge in the photos. Yeah. That's John Ennis. He was one of the regular cast members on Mr. Show, which is where I knew Bob Odenkirk. Right. You know, that was back when we were doing the postgame show, was when Mr. Show was on.
Yeah, David Cross and Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Still one of my favorite shows of all time. And Ennis not only gets this chance to be on Better Call Saul, and I think he's one of like second or third different Mr. Show alum that's appeared along the way, but I didn't know this until I listened to the Better Call Saul Insider. His daughter, Jessie Ennis, is the actress who is the secretary for Davis and Maine, who's there instructing the folks on the call. And she's on Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus and is hilarious. I mean, she's a part of the regular cast. As soon as I saw her, I'm like, oh, Mythic Quest, when she popped up a couple episodes ago. So it was a father-daughter acting with John and Jesse Ennis in the course of that episode. I just thought that was a really cool, really, really cool moment. But when Howard came into the room at the end of the episode, right, I thought that's obviously Patrick Fabian's swan song, right? That's his big monologue. That's his three-page to wrap up. They gave him something good and meaty, but I really thought he knocked it out of the park, man. What an incredible way for that character to wrap up. And what he says to Kim, you've got a piece missing. I feel like that's a critical part of what we've got left to see.
Yeah, it's a good point. He's Howard is not a dummy. He's observant and, you know, he's perceptive. He always had that with Charles and Jimmy. He knew what was going on. He just didn't feel like it was his place to step in between the brothers. But he saw the dynamic. He kind of knew it from the very beginning. And that perception follows him right to the very end, you know, looking at Kim and wondering why make this decision? You could have done exactly what you wanted to do. There must be something there that I'm missing or I can't see, that piece that's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like Leopold and Loeb. You're in it for the fun. I mean, that was a crazy historical reference, but I think it's a great character to have, someone who is smart enough to understand everything that's happening, but he just wasn't quite smart enough to be one step ahead of these guys, to be able to at any point cut them off at a corner, you know, and deflect this plan.
In a way, Skylight in Breaking Bad was no dummy at all, but, you know, was there as kind of the person who wasn't in on it and could only observe a little bit from the outside. I know it's a very different dynamic, obviously, but it's an interesting kind of comparison because you do need that sort of character that's not in on all the bad things, but can be close enough to it that they can comment and observe and kind of give our reaction to it being on the outside looking in.
Yes, absolutely. So that scene's happening. And you're wondering, like, is this going to be the end of the episode, right? Is the issue going to be that Howard is now almost like Hank was at the mid-season finale of Breaking Bad, going to be just set against them. And that's going to be, you know, he's going to take down, get Kim disbarred. And this is going to be the impetus, you know, that we see. No, Lala walks in the room. Our two timelines converge. And when that candle flickered, man, and that was some great acting from Bob Odenkirk and Ray Seahorn, the terror, but the difference in the terror, because then one little moment for Kim Wexler came to roost. She never told Jimmy what Mike Ehrmantraut told her, that Lala was alive.
And yeah, so Jimmy, you know, Bob had to play it with a lot more surprise, where Kim was playing it simply with terror and realization, but both with shocked expressions, but slightly different shocked expressions. That's a great point.
And watching it a second time, this really stood out. Jimmy goes, "How?" And then Kim jumps and goes, "Howard, you've got to go." Because you've got to think that what Bob was going to say is, "How are you alive?"
Which would have been bad.
How are you here? Like, what, you know, what is going on? Right. That would be really bad. So just like a 509, she's saving him with a clever and well-timed word right there. But man, what a absolute stunner. And now, you know, I really feel like, you know, we'll speculate more after the break too, but I almost wonder if this is to be the note for Kim. It's not fun and games. You don't just get a fancy top tequila bottle at the end. You don't just get to have sex while you listen to the phone call of the settlement. Like, there's real world consequences to what you do. And Jimmy learned that with Chuck, but Kim now has seen the brain splattered on her apartment floor of this man who has no reason to be dead. She messed with him for no real good reason to begin with. And now what she did, I mean, she's smart enough to obviously put this together after they survived the next scene. What she did, she killed Howard.
Yes. I mean, you know, that, I mean, anyone could have been there, I guess, at the apartment at the end. You know, that's more bad timing in terms of when Howard arrived, when Lalo arrived. I mean, I don't think Howard died because he was Howard. He died because he was there.
Well, but he's only there because Kim turned around to make sure that they got the right. Jimmy was going to call off the gambit.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's the butterfly effect for sure.
Yeah, exactly. By going after Howard, the unintended consequence is Howard's dead. And that's not what you expect in these little courtroom games and these little parlor games, but now we're in a real life game. And that's what Jimmy learned in Bagman in episode 508 last year, when a gun was pointed at his face and he was a second away from being dead before Mike saved him from the sniper rifle. Now Kim has seen that death. And when Jimmy was ready to walk away from this world, Kim kept him in it, roped him in at the end of season 5, roped him into this. I mean, really convinced him into the Howard plot, although he's a fully willing participant. Right. And yeah. Then I think critically that moment, I forget the exact episode, whether it was 3 or 4, where she relayed to him the opportunity to testify and said, "What do you want to be, a friend of the cartel, or do you want to be a rat?" And to me, that was kind of like the final, I can't turn back because, you know, there's no approval here. So she's really kind of paved the way with every one of these decisions. And it really makes me wonder now, how does she react next?
And she hasn't just paved the way, but it's interesting you use the flooring metaphor. It's slipping Jimmy. She's actually like laying the grease so he can continue to be slipping Jimmy, even when there was an instinct to kind of pull back. And you've seen that instinct to pull back. That was a very key part. We talked about it in the first podcast when they were conning the controller and his wife, the accountant and his wife who were out there.
The Kettlemans,
yes. You know, he wanted to pull back a little bit. He had the sympathy for them that he didn't want to go all the way, but it was Kim who continues to grease the skids of Slippin' Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah, carrot and stick there. She was going to swing the stick. Yeah. So it really does lead me to wonder about Kim's fate, which we're going to speculate on further after this last time out.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, Ben, wrapping things up on our mid-season finale for season six. Remember, July 11th is when episode 8 will come out. And I thought, and here's a very interesting thing that was revealed by Thomas Schnauz on the night of the finale. This was not a, which I think everyone speculated, a network decision for there to be a bifurcated season. This was a result of COVID compliance / Bob Odenkirk's heart attack. And they are like literally working on episodes 11 and 12, like in real time right now, finishing the editing. And so they needed this break to get the whole show out. They needed it to start at when it did to get eligible for the Emmys, but they couldn't, they literally didn't have the show finished in time to run it 13 weeks in a row.
If I remember with Breaking Bad, it was more of a technicality. They couldn't do two seasons, some sort of union pay, whatever. So they just called it one season and split it up into two, but it worked really well for them in that last season, the way they split it up and left, you know, the kind of change in tone when you taught, you referenced it earlier, when Hank finds the Walt Whitman poetry book at the end of the mid-season break, you know that the rest of the show is now going to be Hank versus Walt. In this sense, now that Howard is dead, you know the rest of the show is going to be Jimmy and Kim and Lalo and Mike and Gus and how that all kind of now plays out and the denouement of whatever the storyline ends up being.
Yeah, so here's how I see it right now. I see that there's basically three things left to happen, and one of them we know, and so it's just a matter of watching it, right? So that one we can get out of the way early. Lalo is clearly going to take on the super lab, right? And he's going to lose. I mean, maybe there's some twist out of this where he survives and he's the cucaracha and just Gus believes that he's dead. But Gus says to Hector in Breaking Bad, you know, the last of the Salamancas. So he thinks Lalo is dead by that point. So you assume that it's going to be a clever attack on the super lab, but it's not going to cost Gus any of his captains, right? Because those guys will be killed in Breaking Bad later. It's obviously not going to cost him Gus. And we saw Gus plant his pistol inside the machinery inside the super lab. So I feel like we've already even almost got the clue situation. Gus Fring with the pistol in the super lab.
It's in the meth lab.
Yeah, you know, that's how Lalo's going to meet his end, I figure. So that's going to play out, but I hope they don't drag that out. I feel like they can't. I feel like Lalo's going to come at them quick, right?
Yeah, possibly. And then what do we move on to? Gene Takovic at the end and fast forward many years?
Well, there's two things left to me then that we don't know. What's Kim's fate? Is Kim going to be pinned for the murder of Howard? Howard's dead in her apartment. And she is definitely part of this conspiracy. And there's one person I can think of, Ben, that could put together every single aspect of this conspiracy and make a great legal case. And that is Clifford Mayne, attorney at law, played by Ed Begley Jr. Because, first of all, Howard explained the whole thing to him, right? But he was
he didn't believe it, but he knows it. Yeah.
And he was at the meeting with Kim where they staged the kick out of the whore from the car. So he would have a reason to consider Kim and Jimmy right? As
being he's a big complicit. Enough actor who's had a small enough role that they can certainly give him some meat in the end if they wanted to, especially consider how much smaller the universe is getting.
Yeah. So does, I mean, Kim could be disbarred. Kim could be arrested. Kim could be in jail. Or Kim could double down with Lalo. Maybe go in. Maybe she's the Salamanca's actual attorney and moves to Mexico.
Which I had thought as well, that she becomes a cartel lawyer. I also consider the possibility that Lalo is going to ask Jimmy to do something that even Jimmy is like unwilling to do, whatever it is, so bad that Jimmy can't do it. So he uses Kim as leverage, as a hostage of some sort, to force Jimmy to do something that even would be beyond the pale for him.
Yeah. We don't know. I trust these writers, but these are the things I'm seeing so far as possible scenarios. And hopefully they surprise us with something completely different. Last question is, how much time? We've got 6 episodes. I feel like you could do 6 episodes easily resolving the cartel situation and what happens with Jimmy and Kim. But we've got the Gene Takovic and the teaser after the episode had the Gene Takovic black and white and had that kind of older voice saying, after all this, a happy ending. So I feel like we're definitely going into this world. Do you feel like we go into this world as a coda? Do we go in for 30 minutes? Do we go in 20 minutes an episode, the last 6? Or is it 3 full episodes?
Here's my guess. And maybe this is too prototypical TV, what you get on another series. And I know they like to be a little different, but my guess is the entire 2nd or 3rd to last episode is Gene in the future. While we like take a break from the current plot after a couple of episodes coming back, and we do an entire episode where it's nothing but Gene. And there may be some cameos in Omaha of some of the characters later, where you get a full 60 minutes of that storyline. And then we come back for 1 or 2 episodes again to tie up the Albuquerque pre-Breaking Bad portion.
Yeah, I could see that. It's right. Do a bottle. It could even be the first one out of the shoot. You could even, if they wanted to be real jerks about it, they could do the first one out of the shoot.
Yeah.
Leave us hanging for a whole episode. But maybe they release 2. I don't know. Interesting. Very good. Very good bet. I think it's parts of multiple episodes and all of maybe the last episode.
Yeah, it could be weaved in a little bit more sporadically over the rest. I mean, the way it was done, it was so interesting because it started every season until this one. And would they start the last 6 episodes and do another start like that and go back to Gene? That would make some sense as well. So
the big questions and the big
I have
answers.
One more big question though.
Yeah, what do you got?
It has been reported, I believe, that Bryan Cranston is going to make a cameo somewhere at the end. Do you think it'll be simply, you know, they cross paths at the grocery store, like just innocuous, or will there be something a little more significant? Obviously, he can't know Saul, you know, he didn't meet him until later in the show. So he can't be anything that would have an impact on Walter White's life, you know, that he would remember. But could there be a way that he does play some sort of unknowingly significant role in something that happens?
I'm more of the mind that we're going to have a 6 feet under style fast forward at some point that bounces us into various bits of Saul. You know, that gets us into that mansion that we saw.
Different, back to the timeline of Breaking Bad. So you don't think we'll see Walter in a previous, still as chemistry teacher, Walter White, even thinking about cooking any meth before his cancer diagnosis. You think it'll be something from later on in the timeline going forward?
I do. I feel like that would be too cheeky. I feel like a lot of shows would do that, but that would just be a little bit too cheeky, is for him to be the hot dog, basically to be the hot dog stand guy. Like, oh, hey, what do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, hand me the mustard, you know.
But it's intriguing how they're going to do it, because do you heard that as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think he and Jesse Pinkman, I think.
I think they're both going to be in it.
Aaron Paul, I mean. Yeah. I'm intrigued. Will it be real? Will it be serious? Will it be 15 seconds?
Yeah.
That's my guess. My guess is we're going to be a skipping rock through some parts of the neon suit, Better Call Saul era. And with that, unless you got anything else, we're going to closet and table Better
Until
Call
July,
Saul.
Until July, my minute. Friend. Yes.
Yeah. That'll be it for Better Call Saul. All right. I wanted to get real quick from you, because it's over since the last time we talked, how you felt like Winning Time wrapped up the first season on HBO.
I enjoyed it tremendously, start to finish. Just one of my favorite shows of the year. I know you do your rankings. It would be very high on mine. I loved all of Winning Time, and I loved how it wrapped up. I felt like we have lots of stories still to tell, though, and I'm glad it's coming back for another season. They could do 5 more seasons, I think. They've got enough material and creativity that they can keep going with this Lakers story.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. I really thought there were some powerful and quality performances, in particular the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Spencer Haywood performances. Wood Harris as Spencer Haywood was tremendous. I think that some elements of it were uneven, and I get why Jerry West is pissed off. They've kind of cartooned up, but that's things we knew about Jerry West. Like, he's going to continue doing that his whole executive career, driving around LA, listening to finals games on the radio.
Jerry West is so unintentionally fueling even more of it by his attitude. he's showing by screaming at the top of his lungs, essentially, that that's not who I am. You're kind of showing us that that is who you are.
I absolutely agree. I think that they played fast and loose with stuff just enough. Paul Westhead probably isn't actually quoting Shakespeare at halftime of game 6. Like, almost definitely not doing a whole
scene.
Loved
it anyway. It's fine.
it was a ton of fun. I agree with you. I loved it.
I mean, they haven't even really gotten into Pat Riley coaching. I mean, it was pretty much a foreshadow for Adrian Brody, one of the biggest actors in the entire show. I mean, obviously had a big role, but I need to get way more Pat Riley in the next season.
Oh, I think the next season is that year where they didn't win and Westhead gets booted for Pat Riley.
Yeah.
Right.
He gets to take over. I mean, this must've been the plan all along. I mean, they must've had confidence that they were going, because they left a lot of Pat Riley still to come in that first season.
Yeah. John C. Riley though, man, what a great performance. I thought he just nailed it. And I hope he gets some Emmy consideration. I thought that was a great, great performance.
So what are you watching now?
I'll tell you what, sneak preview for tomorrow. We Own This City. We're doing the segment on We Own This City, because I thought I was all set for catch up as we switched to what we're watching. And I was supposed to finish Atlanta last weekend. I'm a few episodes behind, and I was like, I'm going to finish Atlanta, and I'm going to be ready to talk to Browner early next week, and then I'll talk to Ben at the end of the week. And then your buddy Woods said, hey, We Own This City. It's better than The Wire. You got to check it out. And I said to you on the air.
For sure. It won't be like when you talk about a Marvel show and he kind of starts pretend snoring at the side, like, oh, do we have to talk about Marvel shows again? He has no interest in those. I'm the one who's attentive for those. But he'll like We Own This City talk.
That's exactly right. It's tremendous. And I don't know if it's better than The Wire. I think it's the air to The Wire, and it's the same guys as Pelicano, Simon, Ed Burns. You know, it's incredible through 5 episodes. And so I watched one like on Friday and was like, oh my god. And that's all I did last weekend, was I watched it, and now I'm up to date.
So I've got one that I just started watching that I can almost guarantee you haven't watched yet, because it's almost brand new on HBO. But if you know me, my favorite movie is Back to the Future, and I love time travel stories, and I love the romance element of it. I'm a sap at heart. And many years later, I read the book, The Time Traveler's Wife, and then I watched the movie, The Time Traveler's Wife, and now it's an HBO series that came out, and I think they just dropped the first 2 episodes. I watched the first one, and I was very entertained, because it's right up my wheelhouse, and I enjoyed everything of that before. It's just cleverly crafted. It was a well-written book to begin with. Bouncing a guy who bounces back and forth through time, meets his eventual wife when she's still like 6 years old, and then is a part of her childhood growing up as he goes back and forth to her as she grows. And then she meets him and he doesn't know her because she meets the older him that hasn't traveled back in time yet, but she knows him from all of his visits from when he's older. So it's very complicated, but it's usually the book was worth it. The movie was worth it. And so far I've enjoyed the first episode of the new HBO show as well.
And I saw, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow is the female lead, right?
Ygritte. Right? Is that her yes. name? Redhead. Yeah, the redhead. That is her. I didn't realize that was her, but that you're absolutely right. That is her.
I saw her in Vigil as well this year, and I should go Google her name real quick, but I'm not there on the screen right now. The other one that we'll talk about tomorrow and that I've just caught up on and should talk to RJ Sproul about very shortly is Barry. And Barry is, Barry's the kind of show that, like, I feel like you're in or you're out on the humor of Barry, because it's very well crafted. It's extremely dark and it's staying dark in season three. So if you're in that kind of black humor mood, you can handle it. I was really enjoying my watch through of season three, and then all the horrible shit that's happened this week happened. And I didn't want to watch a show about a hitman that has a bunch of black humor in it. So your mileage may vary along those lines, but
I watched the first episode. I went back a couple of weeks ago to see if I wanted to race through it. It didn't grab its clutches in me right away. I'm not saying that I won't ever go back, but didn't get past the first one yet.
Yeah. And I think you need a couple, three to catch the real riff of the humor and for NoHo Hank to really get his claws in you. Cause it's one of the best comedic characters of the last 4 years. Is NoHo Hank 100% one of the best comedy performances on the screen anywhere, big screen, small screen, is NoHo Hank. So at least give him a chance to get you laughing, because that'll keep you coming back. And there's so many great actors, from Stephen Root to, of course, Bill Hader. So a great show, but a little bit, it's so quirky. It's quirky and it's different. And so it's kind of a mood and it's a different thing. Well, buddy, I'll let you get back to your work. I appreciate you as always. And we've got a couple more dates in the summer when we get back to these final six episodes.
We'll talk to you sometime, probably in late July.
Indeed. Yes. 3 weeks. Yeah, exactly right. Cause we'll cut it in half again. We'll do 8, 9 and 10, and then we'll do 11, 12 and 13 to wrap
it up. Sounds good. It's a date.
All right. For Ben Higgins, I'm Craig Elston. Still to come on Crossing Streams, a recap of Atlanta, Barry with RJ Sproul, Winning Time with Chappelle, Pachinko with Liddy, and now I got to maybe get Woods for We Own the City, because it's that good. I'm going to definitely have to talk about it. All these episodes still to come, but thank you for making it to the end of episode 181 of Crossing Streams. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.